Jeff, last night for dinner, I had a jalapeno popper burger, and I have to say it was fantastic. So, I mean, it's like a
I don't know,
normal
man.
it's a burger, right, with bacon on it. And then instead of like ketchup or mayo, whatever, it had a jalapeno, like cream cheese, like big old layer on it. And it was working. It sounds kind of weird, but it was wonderful.
So it wasn't like a rodeo burger where it's like just onion rings on a burger. You didn't just have legit jalapenos on top of a
No,
hamburger patty.
they were like chopped and mixed in with like the cream cheese and then just spread on top of it. And then so it was like bottom bun, and then there were lettuce, onions, pickle, the patty, and then cheese, bacon, and then the top bun had the cream cheese jalapeno like schmear.
Okay, I'm having a hard time like conceptualizing this, but
Let me see if I can find a picture of it.
yeah, it sounds appealing at least. Like at first I did. I just thought you had a regular cheeseburger and then you put jalapeno poppers on it. It seems gross, but this seems a little bit more it's been a long day. I don't know what the word is. A little bit more, like cuisine, more, I don't know what the word is.
Right.
Thought
Well,
out.
yeah. I mean, it's just like you've had guac on a burger, right?
Right.
It was like that, but instead of being avocado spread on there,
Yeah, okay.
it was like cream cheese. And
Okay.
so
That's appealing.
yeah. And so it was just like, I mean, added fat from the cream cheese. Cream cheese is good. It add a little bit different flavor to it that you don't usually get in a burger. Not as quite out there as like the is putting peanut butter or a fried egg on a burger. But then, it was good. So I guess what is your like preferred if you go like off the wall or non-traditional burger topping? I do love a
It's
fried
hard.
egg. If you've ever had a fried egg on a
Yeah,
burger,
I love an egg, and that's what I was just going to say is I don't know. It's hard for me because I do some weird things, so I don't know what's considered traditional and what's not. Like I love eggs on a burger. Like I think that changes the entire burger. Just any burger, pick a burger, throw a fried egg on top, and it makes it better. I mean, like pastrami, right? Like I don't know, pastrami isn't your standard. But is, traditional burger topping, but does that count as untraditional? I don't know. I eat pastrami. I
I
love
think
onion rings on a burger. So
I was.
it's just hard for me to say like what's traditional and what's not, but all of those things are good. Lucky 13 has it's out in Salt Lake. At this point, I think most people in Utah have heard of Lucky 13, but their peanut butter burger is fantastic.
I
So
don't
there's a
think
lot
there's
of
a.
good.
I don't think you can get a bad burger at Lucky 13.
No, they're very, very good. Okay, I'm looking at a picture of your jalapeno burger now, and that I like this. This is different than I thought. Yeah, that looks good.
It was
I
a
will say
nice
this.
change of pace. Like it was close enough that you're not like, this is what am I eating? But it was,
Yeah.
it was a nice introduction of something different to the burger game.
I mean, I don't eat vegetables just as a rule. Because vegetables are kind of gross. And I know that I'm weird and I still have that's like the side of me that is still 7 years old. I just never really matured past chicken nuggets and fried food a little bit. So the only problem I see with this burger that you sent me is the lettuce, tomato, and onions. I don't like raw onions. I could cook an onion, it tastes different. And I just don't like, and I'll eat each of these things individually outside of a burger. But when it comes to a burger, I don't know what it is, but fresh vegetables on a burger has never made sense to me. I don't like it because it's like the tomatoes get hot and soggy. I think that's gross. Lettuce is gross on a burger. It just kind of makes everything messy. So that's my hot take is even if you like vegetables, take them off of your burger and the burger is better almost every time. I think
Okay.
that is true.
I mean, I enjoy like the crunch of lettuce on my burgers. I can't really taste it, right? Like I want to have it so like I can't really taste the lettuce, but I enjoy the
It's a waste
variety of the texture.
of something else.
Yeah.
Well, I'm probably the minority here because they've been
No,
putting
I think there's
lettuce
a
on a
lot of
burger
people.
for a long time.
I think there's a lot of people who are feeling that same way. you are, and we'll probably get some hate mail. I don't know, but if you have hate mail, send it Jeff's way and leave me alone. So we do have, it is signing day. If you haven't noticed, I don't know which, you know, rock you've been living under. If you care about sports at all, you would, you know, should know that today is the early signing day. And there's a lot of guys. I think this is probably, this is my favorite class of the Kalani Sitake era. There are a lot of what I would say are dudes in this class where you watch their tape and you're like, oh, that dude, he's a dude, right? Like he, that kid can ball. And so, I mean, signing day always brings up a lot of kind of the same things I get rehashed over and over again, meaning you'll get people other talking and complaining about class ranks. I just pointed out earlier that right now, if you look at the 24/7 team rankings, the gap between number one and number 20 is the same as the gap between number 20 and number 110 in the country. So it's like, once you get past those, you know, like the top 15 and really the top 20, like they're cleaning up on the 4 and 5 star guys. But then once you get into the 3 stars, like you're splitting hairs. And a lot of that, especially if you look at the 24/7 class ranking, is driven by, you know, who is what the other, like what ESPN and Rivals rate them. Because the 24/7 composite score combines 24/7's rating, Rivals, which is the Rivals basically doesn't really watch film, right? Like they, and neither does ESPN. It's more or less just based on offers. Whatever offers get reported, then they, the whole SEC offers you, they assume you're good and you get made a 4-star is more or less how they are working. And there's even, if you don't believe this, there's a whole article about how there were some kids that made a fake page on Rivals and reported a bunch of offers and got a fake recruit bumped up to be a 4-star. And
I used to write for Rivals. I actually did on 2 separate occasions. And look, I don't want to disparage my former employer, but they weren't really my employer. Mitch Harper was their employee. I worked for Mitch. So I feel like I can disparage them if I want to. And I want to just testify to how true this is. So I used to go in. BYU is a little bit unique, right? They're recruiting. They offer a lot of guys early. They offer a lot of guys who are truly under the radar, which is hard to do in today's day and age. That's what happens. And especially those early guys, they end up go and they blow up. So with that, I created a lot of the profiles on Rivals for guys that BYU was after. And occasionally, most of the time BYU would offer a guy and they were the only offer at the time. Occasionally, a guy like Kimo Makaniole, I didn't create his profile on Rivals, but he's a good example that is recent because he's in this class. But a guy like Kimo Makaniole, for whatever reason, did not have a profile on 24/7 Sports by the time BYU started to get, you know, heavily involved. And when I created Kimo's profile, he had offers from a handful of P5 schools like Duke, you know, some of those ACC schools that are kind of obscure. He had a bunch of G5 offers and then BYU. So he probably had 10, 12 offers at the time. There were guys like Kimo when I was working at Rivals as well, that just somehow didn't get a profile for whatever reason. And then I was the one who happened to create it. So when I would create a guy at Rivals who had just a BYU offer, when the rating came in, without fail, I could count on that rating being like a 5.3 on their scale. And so that was right on the brink of 2 to 3 star and usually fell on 2 star. They have some weird rating system that nobody really knows. I don't like the lack of transparency, but it was almost always, if it was just a BYU offer, 2-star guy. Chase Roberts is an example. When I created Chase Roberts's profile, 2-star guy, like that was his rating. And when I created the guys who had offers, so the guys like Kimo in this class, when I created those, if they had P5 offers, without fail, that default rating that would come in was like a 5.5, like a mid 3-star. If I happened to put one of the top 25 schools on there, one time I accidentally did. One time I meant to put, I can't even remember who I was going for. I meant to put, it was a, it was a, it was like an FCS school, like UC Davis or something like that, that a kid had a low level offer. And I meant to put that, but I was reading something or listening to something or whatever, and I accidentally hit USC. And so I gave him a USC offer when he wasn't even close. And the rating that came in 3-4 days later was like borderline 4-star. And I was like, whoa, wait a minute. And then I looked and realized, oh crap, I made a mistake. And I went back in, deleted the USC offer, put the UC Davis offer, and his rating stayed the same, like, because they don't go back in and change the rating once that rating came out. That's how it worked at Rivals, guys. Like the offers, that's just what it was. The ratings were just driven by the offers. At 24/7, it's very, very different, especially guys like the ones that BYU so frequently goes after, where I'm the one creating the profile. More often than not, when I create the profile, I'll get a call. So I'll submit my own request based on what I know, based on what people tell me about this player. And sometimes they'll take that and say, great, you know, they'll watch a little bit of film and they'll confirm it, and they'll give the guy the rating that I suggest. But more often than not, I'm getting a phone call, I'm getting an email, a text, something that just to say, tell me about this guy. And I'll give my input. The actual evaluator will go and give their input. And there's just a thought process that goes out. And that means that sometimes a player will sit for a couple of months before he gets a rating on 24/7 Sports. Because, you know, Dylan Rollins, this class, was an example that I created his profile and I thought he was a mid 3-star good. But it was hard for evaluators to go and find time to check out a guy in Missoula, Montana. Like, they couldn't get out there to see him live. And when you pull up his film, like, he dominates, but he's playing against nobody. So it was really, really hard to really gauge how good he was. So he sat unrated on 24/7 Sports for a while. And eventually the rating came in and it was about where I thought it would be. But that's just the difference, right? Like, all of that is a long way to say all these other places that just give a rating based on the offers. Like, there is, I can from firsthand knowledge say there is zero thought that goes into that rating. It is, okay, BYU, yeah, you know, they're not a power five. Sometimes they're the top 25, so they're a little bit better than, say, a UTSA offer. So we'll give them a little bit higher, closer to a 3-star, but still a 2-star. That's just what happens. But at BYU, excuse me, 24/7 Sports, I look at Chase Roberts as a great example. He was an 89. Like, he was knocking on the door of a 4-star athlete on 24/7 Sports, even though he only had offers officially from BYU and Utah, because that's all that he was really considering. But 24/7 evaluated his film and said, this dude can play.
Right.
Rivals looked at his offer sheet, said, local kid, two local schools. Yeah, he's a 2-star. And that's what happened.
Right. And so, and even if you look on the class rankings, you will see, so the 24/7, I know they kind of sold themselves as like, oh, we put the composite at the top of everything. And so we're trying to take our bias out of it and give you the best, like, most holistic view. But the fact is they put the most effort into evaluating these kids, and Rivals and ESPN really don't, right? Like, that's why 24/7 has become the service. And so if you look at their class rankings, you'll see the rank in a bold number, and then in a small box underneath it, you'll see another number. And that number is like, so the top number is based on the composite score, which factors in the Rivals and ESPN ranking for that player. And then the one underneath it is the just based solely on their score from the 24/7 only rating. So in most of the time they're pretty close, but you'll see some disparities where, like, Baylor is number 41 on their composite ranking, but they're number 27 if you just look at. So Baylor got a lot of kids similar to, like, those Chase Roberts types, where, you know, probably had offers from Baylor and TCU, SMU, Houston, and other services said, like, oh, meh, probably a big target for SMU or Houston, probably bottom of the priority board for Baylor or TCU, low-end 3-star kid, slap them on there. Where if you watch their film, the kid can play, and they may have just told people, like, sometimes kids just say, no, I'm really interested in staying close to home. I'm not really interested in your program. Like, and I'm in schools move on, right? Like, that happens. And so it's not, once you get past that top 20 really of programs, it's like, it's really splitting hairs, and it's really how good is your evaluation, how good is your player development. And that's really what it comes down to, because it's like, is there a huge difference between, oh, Cincinnati is at the 42 rank class and they got 24 three stars and their average player is an 85 versus BYU is lower because of a smaller class this year, only having 16, but there's an 83.7, right? Like, is that 1.7 average 24/7 rating that big of a difference? No, like it's, you know, there's not, there's nobody, like they didn't have, since he, like they didn't have any four stars, they didn't get a five star kid that's going to be a game changer day one as soon as he steps into the building. But, you know, do you trust your coach's valuations? And I think once basically 25 through 75, all the classes are the same to me. It's like, it depends on who did you hit on, who did you miss on, what, like, how good are your evaluations, because you're going through the weeds and it's fit, it's academics, like it is like cultural fit in the program, it's system fit with your scheme, you know, how much player development, if you do have some type of coaching staff turnover, like are the guys that you brought in two classes ago going to fit in to your new system and things like that, right? Like you have a lot of things like that. And that's what makes the difference in recruiting and building a program, unless you are Ohio State, Georgia, Alabama, Clemson, Florida, USC, that are just sitting at the top 10 every year. And it doesn't matter what you do year in and year out, you're just still going to pull an amazing class. And one thing that people always say, they're like, oh my gosh, like only in the Super Bowl, like of the 44 starters in the Super Bowl, only four of them were four stars or five stars. The rest were all two stars, three stars. Stars don't matter, go and shove. It's like, they don't hand those four and five stars out like candy, right? Like
there's only like 35 stars.
So in 24/7 gives out 32 five stars every year to resemble like a first round draft pick. But if you like the flip side of that is not like you're looking at in doing in statistic, what is called selecting on the dependent variable, where you're saying like, oh, of people in the NFL, there's this many four stars, this many three stars, this many five stars, whatever. When to judge looking at the stars, you need to look at it. And if you flip it around, five-star recruits, it's like 60% of them, I think is the number, end up getting drafted into the NFL. Right. Yeah, so it's like
crazy.
You look at where it's like, okay, the talent is there and people know it's there. And the ones that don't get drafted, it's usually because they end up starring on a season of Last Chance U. And that's the path that their life has taken. It's not because they didn't perform at the collegiate level.
Let's talk though about, let's take our star rating, because stars matter. I think that's what we've just talked about. We've proven that. And let's apply it towards the videos that get tweeted out by the schools when a player signs. So BYU's, they went with a classic video this year, right? Like it was a coach is sitting in the team room. He gets an alert on his phone, pulls it up. It's an edit of the kid, the actual recruit saying, hey, my name is Raider DeMooney. I am proud to be part of the Top Guns 21 recruiting class, which I have some thoughts on that here in a minute. And then it goes into the coaches now watching their highlights. Like it's a pretty classic, nothing super crazy, but it's really neat. It's really well done. If that is a star rating, I'm giving that a high three star. Like it's not going to blow anybody's socks off, but you're always happy to have that. I want to get your thoughts on what Utah did this year. So Utah, I love the concept of what they did.
I didn't even see it. Let me take.
Yeah, I just sent you a link. So I love the concept of what they did. They, how do you explain this? They went through, like it was the National Signing Day graphic, and then you pick your player, and it was like you're picking your player like a profile on NCAA 14,
like the
right?
Create a start your story, like
yeah. Where they came from, and it looks like you're playing a video game, and it's kind of cool. But then they get to the highlight portion and they made their own video game. And I understand
or took from 24 or busted out their Xbox 360 or PS3 and pulled out the NCAA.
I thought that might be the case, but they have like their modern jerseys. Like they're using the throwbacks that they wore this year. last year, I guess.
I do know the U does have a video game development program.
Okay.
It's a graduate program, so they probably could have done some graphics like that.
So I'm sure that's where it came from. Now, I want to get your thoughts. What star grade are you giving that? I'm giving the idea. I think the idea is a 5-star idea. I think it's great. I think the deployment and the actual production value here that I'm seeing, I'm really struggling to wrap my head around it. Like, why are you showing made up video game highlights of a player in a Utah uniform against Washington who has never suited up yet? Like, these highlights are fake.
Yeah, I would have just.
It also looks like I'm watching.
Intro, I would have just cut to their.
To real highlights.
Yeah, I would have just cut to real highlights.
Yeah, so like bag the video game thing. The video game thing to me, and it's not even like modern, like Madden 21 graphics of this video game. Like, it looks like I'm playing a football game in 2015. Like, it's a little bit blocky. It's a little bit, I don't know, it's weird to me. So the whole idea was great, but I think that the ultimate end product was not great. Now I'm going to send you one more because I want to send you two more. We've got to talk about Nebraska. Like, their videos were fine, but the video that I saw of Nebraska was Branson Yeager. And look, I'm not one that likes to crap on kids, but Branson Yeager, you're going to see him announced as a Big Ten transfer who signs at SUU in a year or two. Like, it's just going to happen. But I want to send you a Liberty's video. Liberty's was absolutely fantastic. They won the video of the day for me, from the music to the graphics to the editing and the way that it all comes together. They created their own like Sports Center desk, had their own hosts who are good hosts. Like, it wasn't, you know, with all due respect to Jerem Jordan and Spencer Linton, like, these guys sounded like they could be on Sports Center, not on a BYU show. And they had like a...
Ooh, this is nice. They
invested
well
some money into this. So we're going to put these in our show notes. I want to hear what you guys think. Like, because these things are kind of fun. They're really for the fans, and it's just to make the kid feel loved. I love what Liberty did. They won the day for me. Arizona State also had some good ones. Oregon's were really good as well, but Oregon's were kind of what you'd expect from Oregon. It felt very just Oregon-y. But I don't know, kind of the fun stuff. I love Arizona State's. I'll send you that. Arizona State's, that they can play on the Sun Devils. I thought theirs was great. It's like a CD jacket.
Utah State is nice and very simple. Like, Utah State is very much in that 3-star thing. They just very simple, like going in the locker room, kind of zooming in on like a number with a graphic. Like, it's not anything crazy, but it's just very solid, gets the job done, right? And they had a very small class, and I mean, they got problems up there, as everyone has, I'm sure, has seen in the news.
Check out the Arizona State one. I like when there's creative ideas like this one and they pull it off, and it's like, okay, that's cool. So what Arizona State's was, is it's like an old school, like a CD, right? And it makes the player's face look like a Sun Devil. Like, they give him the maroonish color and yellow eyes, and then a Sun Devil actually appears behind him. You open up the CD, and inside on the CD jacket is there, like, each track is, you know, the name, where they came from, position, height, weight, stuff like that. Just a nice little graphic. I thought this looked great. Arizona State did great. So check some of these out, you guys, because really it's fun. Like, recruiting isn't fun to follow if you don't make it fun. So check some of these things out. These are some of the fun things that come with recruiting, and let us know what your best ones are. Garrett, you're spot on about problems at Utah State. They're a disaster. And if you're a recruit right now in the state of Utah, or you're a member of the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints, or you're Polynesian, you've got some serious questions about whether you're going to join and play at Utah State or not. Like, they're a mess.
Yeah, I don't, it's bad. I have no idea, like, how, I have no idea how they are there and how that was said. And it's going to be some huge problems there that are going on, and it's not going to get resolved really quick. And I feel bad. I mean, I feel bad for Blake Anderson walking into that position, because apparently that happened the day he accepted the job. And, it sounded like it got the day that it was reported that he was being hired is when apparently that call happened. So he may be walking into a job where there's a new AD and a new university president. And he posted a picture of them having their celebratory, dinner with their new staff. And he was at Texas Roadhouse, because that's the only place to eat in Logan.
Oh, just brutal. So signing day, BYU had a good day, 16 signees. The team ranking, they're in the 70s. Like, that should have been expected. We've been saying that for a long time. I've kind of made it my quest to set those expectations for everybody. I've been going on the radio. I did an interview with the Des News this week, and everything. I've been trying to lay that groundwork of like, guys, this is going to be a low rated class. But that 83.7 average star rating, that's the best that BYU has had under Kalani Sitake. It's the best that BYU has had since 2010. Like, this is a, it's the cliche of quality over quantity, and BYU's there. They've done really good this year. I really like, everybody's talking about Logan Fano, John Henry Daly, Raider DeMooney, and for good reason. We've talked about those guys a ton, and we'll probably have more to say as we go throughout the show. But for me, the two best hits, the best gets that really were kind of a surprise were Inoka and Alia Miguel. Those guys are studs.
And I think if they get to play a senior season in California, then they are blowing up. And I think those are solid 4-star guys. And had they been able to spend more time on the camp circuit and get more things like those, I think those are the two crowns of the class for me. Not so much, obviously, Raider DeMooney, John Henry Daly, and Logan Fano are all huge gets, and but they are local. And so it kind of felt, and obviously, Raider and Logan have been committed for a long time. John Henry Daly's older brother, Michael, was already, he's on a mission right now, but is already in the program. We kind of expected for sure, John Henry Daly and Raider DeMooney, because they were already solid. And then it was a little iffy with Logan there for a bit, but Inoka and Aaliyah, the Miga brothers, like that was like a, that was, we swooped in and kind of out of nowhere pulled them. And, kind of thinking about this, and someone pointed this out today, I don't remember who it was, just said like, if Utah had not committed to playing high school sports, and I know like obviously Jackson Dart blew up this season, if high school football gets canceled in Utah, Jackson Dart is probably going to BYU.
Yeah, for sure.
And because his only other FBS offer at that point was Louisiana, and he probably was not going to go down to Lafayette and play in the Sun Belt.
Yeah, for sure.
So this year was just so weird. And in some cases it really helped BYU and a lot of, in some players and other places, guys, that you think are kind of under the radar really had a chance to blow up because there was no film to evaluate out of California. A lot of coaches had time to spend time watching guys that they maybe wouldn't have watched otherwise.
It's true. And I'm with you. So on one hand, the pandemic and the decision to play hurt BYU because Jackson Dart went to USC, but it did. It absolutely helped with Danoka and Elia Miguel. I just love those two. I love what those two bring to the table. So their story, Anoka's probably the more prototypical prospect in terms of his size and length. He really made some strides going into his senior year. So as a junior, he had good highlights, but he was a little bit, I guess as a sophomore, he was a little bit undersized still. Like the strength hadn't come yet. The height hadn't come yet. It started to come in as his junior year, but even from his junior year until February, there was an Under Armour camp in February. He had grown and he had gotten a little bit bigger, and he had a great showing that Under Armour camp. And within a couple of weeks of that camp, I think it was early February, end of January, within a couple of weeks of that camp, he had pulled in offers from like Michigan State, Colorado, San Diego State, Arizona State, handful of P5 schools. And it was clear that he had like arrived, like he was officially on the radar after that camp. Now, a lot of those schools, Arizona State in particular, Colorado to a certain extent, their strategy is to offer more, offer first, right, to get into the door and then go and evaluate and kind of sort through, you know, their priority, their hierarchy of who their main targets are or not. And other schools will typically, they want to go and they want to see a player in person before they extend an offer. So they show up at this camp, they start to get the offers from those schools that will offer first. And they started to get the attention from the schools who are saying, hey, we'll come see you in the spring and then we'll offer you. And then 3 weeks later, COVID happens and shuts everything down. So there was not the chance for the rest of the Pac-12 to go out and see the McGow brothers play in their spring football practices. They couldn't evaluate them in person. And then they couldn't evaluate them during the season because California didn't play at all. And so I firmly believe you're right that those two both, Elia's a truck. Like he's just, I think Jeff Grimes said he just destroys people. And that's what he does. He's just huge and he moves really well. He's super strong. They're both vastly underrated. And it really is a product of the only film that, whether it be a talent evaluator at 24/7 Sports or a college coach, they've got one camp in February and junior film, and that's it. That's all they've really been able to see.
And even sticking in the offensive line, sometimes getting that senior film makes a huge difference, right? Like we pulled in Sione Hingano from Chandler, who is someone who his junior film was very meh, but then he had a bit of a growth spurt. His body went from awkward teenager to a little more filled out, and he, you know, saw a jump in his athleticism and what was there to work with, and he played very well in Arizona and against good competition. And so that is he's a kid where, you know, he maybe, if the season gets canceled, he doesn't have an offer anywhere, right? Because he was under recruited and he is maybe kind of a fringe, a little more of a project because he is like raw, but it's, you're kind of looking at it and saying like, okay, like your body took a big jump. That means you're probably not done growing. Let's try to, like, you know, we think you could probably do something even another year, get you in the weight room. You're not tapped out yet. Like we are, think you have a fairly high floor, but a pretty maybe higher ceiling. We don't know quite where you'll land. Right. And so for those kinds of kids, that senior year is crucial to be able to start racking up and giving yourself more opportunities. More opportunities to play. So I think, who do you think is the best hit of this class? Like, who do you think by the end of their career is going to have been the greatest contributor?
I'm telling you, I am a firm believer in both Elia and Inoka. I think that is even ahead of Fano, Raider, John Henry Daly. They're going to be great, but I think that people are expecting them to be great. And I think they will be. I think that Anoka Miguel, if BYU doesn't have Logan Raider and John Henry Daly, we're talking about the Miguel brothers. We're trying to sell that as, hey, this is the cream of the class, right? This is the pinnacle. And I think they would deliver in every way. I think that is, for me, the biggest hit, because I think that they will outperform their status in the class. I'm also pretty high on Dylan Rollins. Like, he's my guy. Like, I really like Dylan Rollins. Dylan followed me on Twitter like 18 months ago, and I checked out his film and I thought, okay, like he's got something. Like, it was clear that he was playing against nobody out there in Montana, but he was big, he was physical. And so I put him on my radar about a year and a half ago, and I've just kind of tracked him ever since. BYU extended an offer about 6 months ago. And so I've gotten to know Dylan a little bit. We've talked on multiple occasions, you know, a lot over the last year and a half. And I think he's got it as well. I think he's a player who's going to make a difference. I'm anxious to see. He's truly 6'6", 285 pounds. He'll be 6'6", 300 pounds before too long. he plays with an edge. And I like that from, you know, everybody says that. You like it from an offensive lineman that you want him to just have that nasty. Well, he really does. Like, he's just tough. Like, he embodies so much of what makes Big Ten offensive linemen good, that they're just like these corn-fed farmers that are just big, nasty dudes. And Dylan has that. The size is going to come. Even his high school coach has said, looked like he's got every tool he needs. He's not technically sound today. Like, he's not. But he's just big. He's nasty. He plays incredibly hard. I think he's going to get under Jeff Grimes, under Eric Mateos. The technique is going to come. And when it does, he's another one that watch out, because he's going to be really good.
I think for me, the best hits of the class are, having Miguel and there's John Hearn Daly and Logan Fano. And that's, you know, the defensive line is something that has needed a big influx of talent. And it definitely got it today. And looking, obviously, you know, we're 3 years out before really we see a big impact from them. But I think on the defensive line, that's where today signing class is really going to, you know, feel a difference, because we got some pass rushers, which is something that we've desperately needed for the last 5 years. Who is the one for you that got away? I know we always try to say, like, focus on who you got and who's there, but who is one kid that if you could just, you know, say, man, we were so close and he slipped away?
Yeah, I don't know how close necessarily BYU was, but I know that they gave it their best shot. It was Jacob Schuster out of Washington, big defensive tackle. He ended up with Minnesota. I say him because he was such a need. BYU needs defensive tackles, and he fit really well. I could argue Voy Tanufi as well, out of East High School. He's a little bit smaller than Schuster was, so I'd probably prefer Schuster over Tanufi. But both of them are LDS. They both, you know, had connections to the program, and so BYU tried to get both of them. You know, that's the way recruiting is. Like, it wasn't like BYU did anything wrong. Like, they picked different schools. Like, oh well, right? But I would say those two. I'm anxious to see what BYU does with the remaining 6 weeks before, you know, big signing day. Most kids sign early now, so it feels like today is like the signing day, but really signing day is in February. So I'm anxious to see if they make a run at a guy like Victory Vaca. I know that Victory has expressed interest in BYU. He's also LDS. Weight's going to be an issue with him probably throughout his career. 6'2", 350 pounds. He says he's closer to 330 now, but he's a big guy. Typically, BYU under Elisa Tuiaki errs on the side of bring in smaller guys and hope the weight comes, rather than bring in big dudes and hope that you can get the weight off. So I don't know if they'll make a run at Victory or not. But yeah, so Voy Tanufi, Jacob Schuster, those guys seemed like ideal fits at the defensive tackle spot, huge position of need. And so for me, if I could, you know, wave a magic wand and make anybody commit to BYU, it would have been those two.
I think, you know, and it's not like you said, they just chose other schools, but those guys, like, it's not like we didn't get left without, like there's no quarterback in this class, because Jackson Dart was the only quarterback we offered this year. He went to USC. You know, it's not like those guys, like there's no offensive lineman or defensive lineman. The quarterback room is very full right now, and especially with everyone getting this year back, then it's going to be full for the next couple of years. And you know, there are some guys targeted for 2022, so it wasn't, you know, necessarily a huge deal to not get a quarterback this class, even though, you know, Dart is definitely a game changer in what he can do. But with it, you know, all of these guys, like, yes, we missed out on Schuster, but we did get the Dylan Rollins. We did get the Weston Jones. We did get the Sione Hingano. We did get the Migas. Like, there are bodies in the trenches. And I think even on both sides of the ball, offensive and defensively, this is a class that loads up really for the next, I mean, half a decade, right? Of like, there's guys, I don't think there's any on either the offensive or defensive side of the ball. I don't feel like there's any of the guys that they signed today that I'm like, that's kind of a reach. I don't think he'll ever really amount to much. Like everyone, you watch a film, you're like, okay, this kid can play. Like, I don't know, is he going to necessarily be an all-timer and get drafted in the first round of the NFL or, you know, turn out like Brady Christensen? No, probably, you know, most of not. But it's, you look at it like, does this, you know, compared to in years past of the guys that have been coming in to round out the class, are they better? Yes. Like, I think top to bottom, there's more solid depth when you look down and there's not just, there's not a single guy in the class that I'm like, yeah, this was kind of just a late offer that we got, or we threw that out there because we had one to give and you were a fringe.
Yeah, I mean, when the closest thing to that is going to be Sione Hingano, and there's a very, very reasonable explanation for why he's in the mix, right? And anybody who watches his progression from his junior to his senior year is going to get it. It makes all the sense in the world. The dude works hard. And that's what's, I think, maybe the most special about Hingano and why you're okay taking that risk is that for the most part, that progression came on his own. He wasn't able to work with coaches or his team for most of the offseason because of COVID. And so he took a huge step forward based on his own work, his own hard work and merit. And if you're Eric Mateos and the philosophy of that, you know, blue grit that he tries to instill in his offensive linemen, that's exactly what you're looking for. So it makes all the sense in the world why BYU would take a, you know, a little bit of a flyer on a guy like that. So
Hingano also I really he like transferred to a new school too. So he,
correct,
because he transferred from Mesa High to Chandler High. So he also had to, you know, figure some things out as well there. Like he wasn't,
right,
you know, was working into new things and maybe, you know, I mean, Chandler High is the best program, one of the best programs in the state of Arizona. And, you know, he probably got better coaching there than he did at Mesa. And, you know, that aided in his development as well.
Yeah, for sure. So overall, I really like the class. We've got a ton of coverage on, I think I published something like 25 different articles today over on 24/7
how many
Sports
did you
over
write?
On Cougar. I've been writing for the last few weeks. Not few weeks, but probably for the last 2 weeks, I've been preparing for really anybody who even had a sort of a potential to sign with BYU. They got an article from me, just kind of like a skeleton article as I prepared for potentially, right? Potentially them signing. So I think I wrote, I'd have to check my Google Docs, but I think I probably wrote close to 40.
And you are not the only one who does this. Like, is this a bad time to remind you that there is an article that is, if you Google it, it will come up, but there's no link to get to it for the official signing day announcement for Courtland Sutton signing as a defensive back at BYU, that exists on BYUCougars.com.
That is sad, isn't it?
So it's, I think,
even, but it does. Like you
see all of the surface level things, right? And it's, but I think, going back to obviously what you were saying, but then also when we were talking about the schools were not just doing this, waiting for the letters to come in. They have to do it for everyone they know is already committed and then get from the staff and be like, these 15 other guys we think are still making up their mind and there's a chance. So There's a lot of work, like the work you see put out is probably about half of what was actually done.
Yeah, I had about 40 articles out, you know, just like profiles and things. I already released my early big board for 2022. You know, as the coaching staff turns the page on 2021, starts to focus on the future in recruiting, I went ahead and released my big board there. We talked about I have another article out on the projected, you know, quote unquote, real class of 2021 for BYU that includes the missionaries. And there's some studs that are coming in. I mean, Kalani didn't really talk about them today at all. They usually don't. They'll wait until February. Usually they'll announce a handful in the early signing period. But I think with COVID, missions are so confusing and nobody really knows, you know, like when they're going to come back. Some people are going the full 2 years. Some are going longer than the 2 years. Some are going well short. So rather than, you know, figuring out a few, I think Kalani just kind of said, hey, let's just bag it. Let's focus on the recruits. But I went ahead and projected who I'm most confident in coming. And it's guys like Oliver Nasi-Lai, Viliami Tausinga, Campbell Nasi-Lai, Barrington.
That dude hits like a
truck. He's a truck. Oh, yeah. Campbell Barrington is a big one. Clark Barrington. Okay, so when Clark Barrington, who's made a pretty big impact on the offensive line this year, when he was offered it was really easy for people to say, they're offering Clark in an effort to get Campbell. Like, no, that wasn't true. They liked Clark. But that was the thought process because Campbell was such a good prospect already. And so Campbell Barrington's a big deal. He's coming back. Dallin Holker will be back. Brooks Miley is a guy that I'm really, really high on, an inside defensive lineman. I don't think that people are giving him the credit he deserves. He's going to be 6'5", 300 pounds when he gets home. He's fast. He's physical. He's strong. I think he's a guy who's going to be in the mix. The faster he can shake off his mission rust, the faster he gets onto the field. If he's in shape, he's able to go. I think he plays almost right away. Cade Albright comes back. Chase Roberts comes back. So a lot of really good missionaries are coming back and set to join the program. Chase Roberts, I have his profile pulled up, but just to kind of illustrate what we were talking about earlier, his composite score that aggregates all of the scores is an 84.1. His 24/7 sports score is an 88. Like, you don't usually see a discrepancy that large. That tells you, okay, 24/7 sports had him at an 88. That means that 20, or, you know, that Rivals and all those others, they really have to have him as a two-star player to get to that 84 rating.
Yeah, actually, let me try to find his, pull up his Rivals.
I'd go look, but I'm sure it'll just upset me.
If it will load the number you said, 5.3.
It happens every time.
You were dead on.
Every time, man. Like, if you look, I have not looked. I know that Dallin Hevea was not rated on Rivals until I think this morning. If you're there, pull up Dallin Hevea on Rivals. Just see what his is. I'm going to guess it's a 5.3. I have not looked. He was not rated until this morning.
And Chase Roberts by ESPN was a 77.
I don't know what their scale.
Chase Roberts. I can't even find him on there. Apparently there was a Chase Roberts who signed with Georgia Tech in 2012. Dallin Hevea is a 5.4.
Ooh, so they gave him a little bit of a boost. Yeah. There we go. Maybe they've changed in the 2 years since I've left. 5.4 is the new default. I don't know. I'm telling you, though, they don't look at film. It's all driven. I guarantee you that I'm not going to name names because I don't know who it is anymore, but the people responsible for the West region, I guarantee you they have not watched Dallin Hevea play one snap, not one. And they gave him a rate. And it irritates me because this is important for the kids. That's what bugs me the most is that, like, hey, these kids want to be rated. They want to be 3-star, 2-star, 4-star, whatever, to put on their Twitter bio. Like, this is a cool thing for them. And Rivals doesn't even take the time to try. They're like big posers in it all. And it just drives me up the wall.
So they have Inoka Migao is a 5.5. They also have Tavita Mafileo still listed as a commit. And well,
that's
also
been a while.
At a 5.5. So Rivals is a little behind the ball there. Rivals also has Hinkley Ropati listed as a member of the 2021 class.
Well, I mean, Rivals, this should tell you everything really that you need to know about Rivals and how seriously they take BYU. Go ahead and go to CougarNation.com and just look at who wrote the most recent BYU article. It was me. I wrote it. I haven't written for Rivals for 2 years, but I was the one who wrote the most recent article for CougarNation.com.
So I think plenty of recruiting talk. Let's get forward to, we have a game to preview. There's going to be, before we record our next week's episode, there will be a bowl game against UCF. And before actually we hop into that, I do want to take a minute to thank our sponsor, Teeples Consulting. If you have a small bit to medium or large size business, really any size business, they will work with, you know, just a few people in a shop who need an extra hand, or up to large companies like TeamViewer, Ancestry.com, and even Brigham Young University, directly with, you know, bringing in outside consultants to help get data and processes in place and streamlined to help your business have data-driven decisions. Guiding your next steps. And so if you are interested in that, that is something you need, or you just want to talk about Cougar sports, give Ryan a call. You can get their information at teeplesconsulting.com. That's T-E-E-P-L-E-S consulting.com. So with our UCF preview, Jeff, we got to talk about boomers for a second. Now, I know about a year ago, there was this thing where people, you know, if you said something stupid or outdated, people were like, okay, boomer. Like if you got, you know, if you were kind of a NIMBY and you heard that term, NIMBY, like someone who's like not in my backyard, going to get upset about this. But people, the biggest or one of the biggest complaints that I've seen with this bowl game is people said it's a sucky bowl game because it's before Christmas. I don't care when the bowl game is. Like I know that used to be a bigger thing where it was like, oh, the sucky bowls are before Christmas and then the good bowls were after Christmas. And then, but then the good, all the bowls kind of started being till after Christmas and there were only a couple before Christmas. And then now it's cut down to really, there's only six bowls that matter. And of those six, only two of them matter. And every other bowl is just like, yeah, cool. Pat on the back. Well done. You get to go be fun. I think personally players would rather have a game. I think most players would rather have a bowl game before Christmas if it was up to them, so they can be done with the semester and home with their families. Like if they, like they don't want to spend the holiday. Like I think probably playing a bowl game on December 26th is probably like the most annoying thing as a player, because they don't get to like spend a normal Christmas. Where if they played on the 23rd or the 22nd, like BYU's going to, they'll have a normal Christmas and get to be home with their parents and their family for the first time in 6 months.
Yeah, and I think this year that's probably more important than it even is in normal years. Like, I don't think we can overstate how difficult COVID has been on these players. Like, all the protocols and all the things that they've had to do in order to play games has been rough. Like, we're all struggling, right? Like, everybody at some point in this pandemic has felt that, felt that just exhausted feeling of I'm sick of being at home, sick of wearing a mask, I'm sick of doing this and that, I'm sick of, you know, we all just want this to be over. And the players feel that too. The players are sick of getting tested 3, 4, 5 times a week. Like the players are sick of living by themselves because they moved out of their housing and into their own house in an effort to be more isolated so that they wouldn't get they were able to minimize their exposure. And so I think this year more than ever, if you're not going to one of the New Year's Six games, who cares? It's just to get into a bowl. And then on the other side of that, you know, to kind of reiterate the point from a different paradigm, there are games that are getting canceled already. Like there've been a lot of bowls that canceled before they even named teams, but even like the Frisco Bowl, it was going to be SMU and UTSA. SMU had COVID issues. The Frisco Bowl's canceled. And so UTSA is hoping to get an opponent in the First Responder Bowl now, but even that's not a guarantee, right? None of these things are guaranteed. So for BYU
the longer you're flirting with it not happening at all.
Yeah, exactly. And so for BYU to say, okay, let's get a game December 22nd, it's a week and a half after their most recent game. UCF is in the same boat. It's in the state of Florida where COVID restrictions are, you know, looser right now than, you know, say California. And so it's like, okay, if we can get this game in, awesome. Like that's the goal. Let's just get it in. People have said, well, a ranked BYU should have been playing a ranked opponent. And I understand the logic. Half of the ranked opponents are playing in the New Year's Six, so those are already taken off the table completely. And then the other games, like the games that are still scheduled to happen, like the Gator Bowl, the Citrus Bowl, those are still contracted, you know, P5 versus P5, SEC versus Big 12, most of them. If you just slate the ranked SEC, Big 10, and Big 12 teams, then they're all gone. All the ranked P5 teams fit into either the New Year's Six or one of those other three bowls, like the, I can't remember which one it is. There's the Gator Bowl,
the Citrus Bowl, and like the Music City Bowl.
Yeah, that's it. Yep. And so if you slot teams into those, like all of the ranked P5 teams are now gone. Like BYU doesn't have a chance to get into any of those bowls. And I think what the committee proved yesterday is even if BYU had beaten Coastal Carolina, they're still probably not in a New Year's Six game. You're still probably playing in the Boca Raton Bowl. Like that's probably what's going to happen. So the only other ranked teams you're looking at, like San Jose State, Buffalo, you know, like,
and they're going to their contracted bowls too, which are worse. So I mean, the book
would a BYU fan be happy? Like, would you really honestly, just because of the little 22 next to their name, would you be happier to play Buffalo than you would UCF? I wouldn't, you know, give me that game against UCF. I get that BYU plays them in a few years, but give me UCF over Buffalo or San Jose or Louisiana 100 times out of 100.
Right. And it's, I mean, UCF is still, they are ranked right now. They are 29th in the AP poll because they're receiving votes. So if UCF wins, they will finish ranked. So it's like, for all intents and purposes, this is a ranked and as good of bowl matchup as it would have been. Now, would it have been preferable, I guess, from an optic standpoint to say play, say like an Oklahoma State team and say get that P5 stamp on there? Probably, yeah. But also if UCF's kicker can make a field goal against Memphis, then they are, instead of 6-3, they're 7-2 and they're ranked number 24. And we're like, oh, cool. This is a solid, good match. This is a good top 25 matchup. And I've heard some people too say that it, I mean, as well, when we're talking about payouts, like I think part of this and what was reported is that ESPN is being this, being an ESPN owned event. The ESPN is honoring and is going to pay the full contracted amount of this bowl. And the full BYU is going to get the full $900,000. And
did you, oh, that's confirmed.
That's someone I saw, I think it was KSL reported it.
Okay. That's a big deal.
Right. And so other bulls are saying it's going to be less. And so BYU is in a position. And so I think, especially for these, some of these smaller bulls, I think people realize that like the, and this is a big problem for BYU for a long time when they were in the WAC, is that we went to a bowl every year and the program lost money because the WAC did not deduct the expenses of going to the bowl game. Because if you don't sell your allotment of tickets to the bowl game, you have to, the program has to buy them from the bowl itself to keep the bowl afloat. And so if you are looking at that, so it's, you know, whatever, or, and then the, obviously the travel expenses and putting the team in the hotel and all of that stuff, it costs money to play road games. And if you aren't getting this, you know, if you aren't getting this money, or the way it worked in the WAC was they didn't deduct it. They just said, oh, whatever the bowl payout is, that's going to get split evenly between the conference members. So BYU would get, you know, say $250,000 for this thing that was split 8-10 ways between everyone in the MAC or in the WAC, but they spent $7,500,000 going to the bowl game and they only walked away with $30,000 for winning. You know, so it's whatever, I don't know what the numbers are exactly back in that era. But so with these bowl games, getting it actually guaranteed and being actually able to play a game, right? Like SMU would have loved to play in the Frisco Bowl because they wanted a check and they need to pay bills. And if this game gets canceled, you know, it's early enough that if it's canceled, there's still time that you could say, okay, we're going to stay ready. Slot us to a bowl on December 27th. We'll be ready to go. Like this gives BYU flexibility to jump in and play any game. And possibly maybe in the, maybe they still do that and say, hey, we're going to try for a second bowl game. Let's do this. And, you know, gives them the opportunity to be flexible. And it is as good of a matchup as you are going to reasonably get in a bowl game. And it's, I mean, even, you know, people you can harp on, but, and we've talked about this too, and like, oh, we should join the AAC or join the Mountain West because this gives us the opportunity to, you know, go to the NY6. Right now, there is no clear path to the NY6. Like, okay, so Coastal Carolina or Cincy, one of those two is going to go to the New Year's Six. They're going to play the worst rated team in that New Year's Six. So they're probably going to end up playing Iowa State. And really, 2 years from now, is anybody going to remember that Cincinnati played Iowa State in the Fiesta Bowl?
Just Cincinnati fans. I mean, right. That's it, right? Like, that's versus the value of the game.
And I've been to multiple Fiesta Bowls, and yeah, it was fun to go to, but it's still what you are trading is when you look at, okay, what the original 21 or 2020 schedule was, or let's take a look at the 2021 BYU football schedule. You are trading, oh, maybe once, maybe twice a decade, you could go to this, or you could play Baylor, Washington State, Virginia, at USC, Arizona, Utah, Arizona State, USF, all in the same season, right? Like that's the, you're getting the quality, like we're getting 1 to 2 New Year's Six type matchups a year, plus a mess of other P5 matchups that are way more fun. And trust me, it is a lot more fun to go and play at Nebraska or at Michigan or at Texas than it is to play them at a neutral site in a bowl game.
It's true. And really the value for BYU as well is that a lot of these P5 schools are coming to Provo. You get to see them play here. And it's a big deal, you know, like that's a lot of fun. I had this argument very early on with people in about independence. And it was exactly that no, like, look, the way independence is set up is it's the bowl games are played throughout the year. And that's really kind of the truth. BYU will play Arizona, Utah, Arizona State. And all three of those games are home games. Arizona's in Las Vegas. It's not really a home game, but you can get to Las Vegas really easy. And a lot of BYU fans live there anyways. It's for all intents and purposes, it's a home game. Utah in Provo, Arizona State in Provo. That's a big deal. That's a really, really big deal. So I like where your head's at. I do think that the NY6, and Kirk Herbstreit also said this, that the NY6 is overvalued now. And it is, it just is. Like nobody remembers even just a couple of years ago, UCF beat Auburn, I think, in, was it Auburn? I think it was Auburn.
They beat Auburn in the Peach Bowl and then lost to LSU. In the
Right. So they beat an SEC team a couple of years ago, and then they claim a national championship for themselves. And now here we are just 2 years later, slated to play them in a bowl game, and people are disappointed. Like that
it's the memory, New Year's Six. The memory is short. And
yeah, that New Year's Six win over Auburn doesn't have any staying power for the national landscape of college football. It's a great win. I obviously we'd all prefer to go to the NY6, but we could be plenty happy about playing UCF. Right. It's not like this season was a failure.
Right. And I think people don't understand that the types of players like in the rise, and I know we've talked about this before, but like Zach Wilson is not playing in Provo and he is playing at either Oregon State or Iowa if BYU is in a G5 conference. Like
period. Like
that period, that is where is that, and things are different. The amount of money coming into the program.
Yeah, I mean you're absolutely right. That is the difference. That's what independence brings. If it weren't for BYU's schedule, if it weren't for, I don't know, you know, if it weren't for a lot of things like that, BYU would they would be in a different situation with the talent. So I like what's happening for the Cougars. I like signing day. I like this matchup against UCF. I don't know if we're going to have a post game show against UCF, given that it's a Tuesday night game and we'll record on Wednesday anyways. Maybe we will. Maybe we won't. I feel like maybe we need to set some sort of a threshold. Like if the over, because these are two high-powered offenses and two less-than-high-powered defenses. Oh, I don't mean to say that. I could almost feel you, like, twitching less than high-powered defenses. No,
I think that we will probably just – we will do a season recap on Wednesday. The game being on Tuesday, we will do our post-game review and a season/preliminary season recap just as our normal show next Wednesday. I like that.
Okay. I'm in. I was going to say some like crazy number. Like if the game total goes over like 88.5, then maybe we have to do a post game show.
I'd say, okay, if it goes over 91.
Okay. 91. 90. Well, we'll go 91.5. Okay. So that we don't 91 push.
And a half.
So if it's a 92, so if it's, what is that? 47, 42. What? No, that doesn't math. What is 40, my math?
92 and 47-45.
Okay. So there you go. It's going to be a high-scoring game.
The other thing on this bowl game that I have seen is people say that, talk about it being a home game for UCF. I think Florida is a big state. Boca Raton is a three-hour drive from UCF, or like from Orlando, where UCF is. So it's still like, they're still going to have to travel. Yes, it's not as far, but they're still going to have to travel. They're sleeping in a hotel away from home. There's limited fans. There will probably be roughly equal, maybe even more BYU fans there. Okay. I know quite a few people, a handful of people who have bought tickets and are going. And BYU's allotment sold out in about 15 minutes, right? Like, it
didn't take long at all.
And so I think it's going to be a good, fun game, which is exactly what you want out of a bowl matchup.
100%. Garrett, let's move on to our picks. Hold on. One more thing before we move on that we do have to cover. Jamie Chadwell was formally extended today. He had been a 7-year extension head coach of Coastal Carolina. It had been rumored for a while that was in the works. It officially came to fruition today. And so a 7-year extension. And the only reason we bring this up is to extend Kalani yesterday. I wrote an article that the time to extend Kalani is yesterday. It's time. And people have said, oh, well, he just got an extension a year ago. Why? Because it's not the same, right? College football is not the same as another business.
It's because David Hickey, the athletic director at Arizona, is ringing up Kalani's phone trying to get him to talk about going to Tucson. And so is right. Every school that has an opening. They are gauging his interest. And so you get the extension. The extension is there, the extension is there to up the buyout. It is to commit to recruiting, and at BYU, where you have a longer recruiting cycle, you need those contracts even to be longer because you need to bake in the extra time for a mission. But if a P5 school comes calling and Kalani leaves, you want that school to cut as big of a check as possible to the program, which is exactly why Jamie Chadwell got a 7-year extension.
Right.
They know
there is no administrator at Coastal that thinks he's going to be there.
They're hoping for 2 and they want 7 years so they can say, oh, okay, well, we were paying him $5 million a year, whatever. But then because he left for another program, there's these kickers and this, and there are different things like that that are baked into contracts where it's like some SEC schools, like you have to pay more if you are leaving for a program. Like if you are leaving to go work at Bama, then the buyout is bigger, even for like an assistant coach and things like that. Like that is a thing, like with program specific kickers and things. You say like, okay, if Jamie Chadwell is leaving for a P5 school and there's 5 years left on his contract, you need to give us double his salary for the remainder of the contract or whatever. And he is doing this, he secures his job, but everybody knows he will not be there forever. But should somebody come knocking and try to get Kalani away and shows him the money, and for whatever reason, he decides to leave, like he doesn't owe BYU anything. If he decides to leave, then BYU wants to have a lot of money to go out and hire the next coach.
Right. Protect yourself. It just doesn't make sense to not extend him, because even if you have to fire him and your own buyout goes up, boosters are paying that money anyways. Like that's the way that it works. So extend him. Nobody complained when Mark Pope got extended through 2027 after one good year. Nobody complained. Nobody said a word. So extend Kalani again. Yes, he was extended last year. I get it. Mark Pope signed a brand new contract last year. Mark Pope had a great season as the head coach of BYU basketball and was extended for 7 years at the beginning of this season. Great. Good for him. Like nobody's upset by that. Kalani's done the same thing. He took his new contract last year, had a great season this year. Give him the same extension. Extend him through 2027. It's time. Like, it just doesn't make sense not to. I think it's ridiculous that it hasn't happened. I think it will happen very, very soon. Hopefully this week before the bowl game, right after the bowl game. I hope it happens that quick, but it needs to happen. So having said that, I'm excited for our picks this week. You've lined it all up for us. It's championship week.
Yes. Let's review our picks for last week. I went 1, 2, 3. I went 5-1 last week. You went 2-4. I'm sorry, Jeff. Both of us picked Arizona to cover the 11-point spread in the Territorial Cup, which ended up being 70-7. And Kevin Sumlin is no longer employed by the University of Arizona.
Hoping the best for my guy, AJ Stewart, though.
Yeah, that was unfortunate that he left and went there. And that, I mean, he got his money, though, for that 1 year. So he's sitting better still than he was before. And I think he is valued in the college football community, and he will land on his feet shortly. And I don't think he'll be hurting for a job. And he's the kind of guy that he may even be retained by whoever the new coach is. So it's not necessarily set in stone. So we have 10 picks today. We have all 10 conference championships. We do not have the BYU game up yet because I have not seen a line for that game yet.
I saw 4. That BYU was favored by 4, but then I saw somebody else say that BYU was an underdog for the first time, and I have not actually seen a line myself. So
we're gonna, if it's an obscure offshore bookie that I have no idea who it is, or just like, you know, some random guy in Kearns who's taking bets under the table, we don't count that here. There's got to be bona fide, real deal casinos.
Why Kearns, man?
I don't know.
What do you got against Kearns?
Okay, fine. We'll go Clearfield. Some random guy in Clearfield.
Oh, you know what? Actually, right here, William Hill just posted their BYU line just a little bit ago. It is BYU minus 4.
Okay. So we will add that. You minus 4 UCF. Okay. So we got 11 today. So we cannot push this week. Our first pick, UAB. This is the Conference USA Championship. UAB is a 3 or 5 point underdog at Marshall. Marshall, who laid an egg against Rice. Did you know that? So if Rice had beaten, I think it was UAB is who they played. If Rice had won last Saturday, UTSA would actually be playing in the conference championship game. I know that game was frustrating when it happened, but they ended up turning it around. They have a lot of young people, and Jeff Traylor has a really good thing going there.
Jeff Traylor's a heck of a coach. I feel like I am a little bit disadvantaged when it comes to the Conference USA, MAC, the Sun Belt games. You follow these tiny little conferences way more closely than I do. I just don't buy Marshall, and that's it. That's really what it comes down to for me. So give me UAB in the points, because I'm not really a believer in Marshall's season this year. And I think that they were exposed against Rice, who was just eh.
Yeah, I think, you know, I agree. UAB, they had a couple, I mean, their few losses that they had, I mean, they lost in overtime to Louisiana Tech. They barely beat Rice, but then it's like, I mean, they played Louisiana Lafayette really close and only lost by 4. They stomped Western Kentucky. They beat UTSA handily. It's UAB is still a good program, and I think I definitely take them to cover, and I would not be surprised if they win it outright. And I think if they do win, this may be a situation where their coach, Bill Clark, starts looking he may be in it, find himself in a Brian Harsin situation where he resurrected them back from the dead after their program was shut down and then rebuilt and took them quickly to multiple conference championships. It might be a good time for him to jump. We'll jump next to the Sun Belt Championship. Louisiana is a 3.5 point underdog at Coastal Carolina. Are the Chanticleers going to win it?
I mean, it would make me feel better if they did. But I hate them. I just have this passionate, fiery hate for them and their mullets. So give me Louisiana because of my hate for Coastal.
I mean, I think it's hard to beat a team twice in a year. And I think that Louisiana is obviously like their only loss is to Coastal. They stomped Iowa State. They stomped number 6 Iowa State on the road.
I
think that Louisiana could just win this straight up as well. Coastal, there were some chinks in the armor. And I think Troy kind of may have shown a game plan that works against their defense as well. And Louisiana is no slouch. And I think Louisiana is going to pull this one out.
I will never hear the phrase chinks in the armor and not remember. Do you remember when ESPN, that when some writer wrote an article after, remember like Lynn Sanity, when Jeremy Lin was on the Knicks and he was through his crazy, crazy, crazy like run of like just insane performance. And then he had a stumble and it was like the first game after this big run. where he didn't perform well. And the whoever the writer was that picked the headline posted a big picture of Jeremy Lin and said, "A chink in the armor."
Oh, no.
And it clearly wasn't meant to be racist, but it clearly was taken.
Oh, right? No.
Like I want to give this, whoever it was, the benefit of the doubt that like they didn't mean to do that. They were thinking of using chinks in the armor the same way you just did, like totally passive, but they didn't put it together that Jeremy Lin is of Chinese descent. And so when you put those two things right there, overlaid over each other, no, you can't do that. And so poor taste. So that's what I think of every time I hear that phrase.
That is really unfortunate.
Yeah, awful.
Okay, down to the Mountain West. Boise State is a 6.5-point favorite against the San Jose State Spartans. As much as I don't want to do this, I think I have to take Boise here. I don't know if I'm sold on San Jose State as a top 25 team, even though they are 6-0. They've been like, they're like a USC undefeated right now.
It's like you're surprised that they are. I don't know if I agree. Here's why I don't. I feel like I want this game to become the winner gets the Arizona job. And I think that Brett Brennan at San Jose State is more likely to be the winner or is more likely to be the next coach of Arizona than Brian Harsin. So I'm going to say San Jose State covers at least, and they might win out of like one more for the Gipper before he takes the new job.
You know, now you have me thinking because it's 6.5. Like, it's will Boise win by a touchdown or is this going to be an ugly game? What's the weather in
Vegas?
They're playing it in Vegas.
Mountain West gave San Jose the home game. And then because San Jose doesn't play, because they use their like computer algorithm or whatever to come up with who the best team is. And so they determined
It's the higher ranked in the CFP and San Jose
State. Whatever it is. Yeah. So San Jose State ended up being the home team, but San Jose State's not playing in San Jose because of COVID. So this game is being played at Sam Boyd Stadium in Las Vegas.
Got it. You know, I would have to say, you know, I think I am as well as I think Boise State wins, but San Jose State will cover. A touchdown is a lot, and I think San Jose State will be fired up, or it will either be a San Jose State cover or Boise State will win by 28 plus. There will not be a like Boise State 10-14 solid in control win. Like, it will either be a hard fought San Jose State close, really close, or maybe San Jose State wins by like 2 or 3, or it will be a Boise State blowout.
Yep. That, I think you're right.
No in between there. Okay, the MAC championship. Ball State is a 13.5-point favorite on the road against Buffalo. I am taking Buffalo because I feel bad for their running back because their coach pulled him 20 yards away from breaking 2 NCAA records. And I'm still angry at that coach, and I want that running back to have another career day. And I think Ball State also is just not that good, and the MAC is horrible. And I have literally only watched one MAC game this entire year. And that was the last 3 minutes of that Buffalo game when the running back, they pulled him as soon as he went over 400 yards and didn't give him one more carry to break the single game yardage record. And well, they put in the backup, and the backup's first carry, he scored a 25-yard touchdown, which would have broken the single game yardage record and the single game touchdown record.
I had no idea that this happened.
The announcers were so mad. Like, the announcers like, no, why are they pulling him out? I am so angry. Like, somebody tell the coach how close this kid is. Like, do they think he already did it? Like, they were upset.
Well, I have no idea. Just for the sake of, I don't want to end up with a tie, I'm going to pick Ball State because I have no idea. Like, no clue who wins.
Remember when Brady Hoke used to be the coach at Ball State?
Yeah, how weird.
Good times. Okay, Tulsa is a 14-point underdog at Cincinnati.
Cincinnati hasn't played in like a month. Like, it's been forever since they've played. And Tulsa's good. I think Cincinnati wins because Cincinnati's the better team. But I think that Tulsa keeps this game close.
I think the interesting question here for me is, if Tulsa, so hold on, let me pull up the CFP rankings really quick. So obviously, if Coastal wins and if Tulsa wins and Coastal wins, Coastal is going to the New Year's Six because they will be the highest ranked champion. If the
And there is that caveat, isn't there? It has to be the highest ranked champion.
Yes. So it doesn't matter how far Cincy drops. If they lose, they ain't going because they will drop out of, you know, number 11. So Coastal is 12, right? They, and no matter what happens, even I would not be shocked if Coastal drops to number 13 because they will not let a second team in. I mean, I don't know. They might leave that there just after the blowback of how stupid the rankings were this week. I could see Coastal sneaking in just because people were so angry about everything.
I agree. I just, the committee hasn't done anything that makes sense yet. So yeah. trying to predict what they're going to do, who knows?
Right. So we have, let's see here, potentials. So conference champions, there's Cincinnati is 9. Coastal is 12. They're the favorites here. And you've got Louisiana, 19. Tulsa is at 23. And then San Jose State at 24. If Louisiana beats Coastal and Tulsa beats Cincy, where do you think that shakes out? Tulsa is 4 spots behind Cincinnati right now. Does Tulsa jump Louisiana, or is it going to end up like Louisiana will move up to like 15 and Tulsa will move up to 16 and Louisiana is going to get the bid?
I don't think that, honestly, if both of those teams win, I think that Louisiana moves up. I don't think Tulsa moves up hardly at all. I think Cincinnati moves way down, like we saw with BYU, like a huge drop. And I think that the committee then says, well, look at Louisiana's resume. They have a win over top 6 Iowa State and top whatever Coastal. And Louisiana ends up being your pick because the likelihood that Louisiana goes in and beats Iowa State again seems unlikely. I think that's what they would do. And I'm a believer in the conspiracy theories and the cabal. So I just think they would look at the matchups and say that Tulsa would beat Louisiana head to head. So let's put Louisiana ranked higher so that the P5 team beats up on Louisiana.
I mean, what a year for the Sun Belt that it's, you know, looking like there's a, you know, there's a chance that, I mean, maybe that either way they could be sneaking a team into the NY6. Because even if Coastal Carolina beats Louisiana, that's a top 20 win for them. Louisiana will probably drop out of the rankings entirely depending on what the game looks like. And so maybe they'll probably tank them so they don't get that in there. But it's, you know, if Coastal finishes 12-0, one, they managed to play 12 games in a season. Mm-hmm. Two, they won all of them. And then if they sneak in to number 11, like, awesome for them in their program. Great year for the Sun Belt. Overall, very surprising. I think the Sun Belt is really shedding because it was always, the G5 was always the American. And before the American, it was Conference USA because that was the American. It was the same thing, right? Like, it was always Conference USA and the Mountain West and then everybody else. And then Conference USA kind of became a laughing stock of sorts, right? Because they pulled up a bunch of FCS schools and invited a bunch of Sun Belt schools, whatever. And then, you know, it's weird how the American was kind of in shambles after the Big East fell apart and now has separated itself as by far the best G5 conference. And then the Sun Belt went from, this is the no-name league of everyone that sucks, and a bunch of their teams left to go backfill Conference USA. And the Sun Belt now invited a bunch of good FCS schools like Georgia State, Georgia State was a startup, sorry, Georgia Southern, App State, and Coastal Carolina. And now it's like that's become a solid pro conference, right? Like, that's the Sun Belt is now probably this year, at least, the Sun Belt is the second best conference behind, you know, the American and the G4. Like, it's the Sun Belt is every bit as good as the Mountain West. And yeah, that's just something weird to think about because a couple of years ago, it was like, okay, it was Mount American, a little bit of a drop to the Mountain West, good size drop to the MAC, but the MAC was still respectable because it's been there forever. And then you had the Sun Belt and Conference USA down at the bottom, no one thinking about either of them.
I think the Sun Belt, here's my innovative conference commissioner hat. The Sun Belt, I don't even know if this is possible, should dip into the HBCUs and go get Jackson State now that Deion Sanders is there and they're flipping commits from Georgia.
Okay.
Give them a little bit of money. Did you see that today? They flipped a four-star corner from Georgia that's going to Jackson State to play for Deion Sanders. So just take a little bit of a gamble. Sun Belt, Fun Belt. Go add Jackson State. See how good they can become. Turn Jackson State into a powerhouse. I think that they could get there. I have no idea what kind of a coach Deion Sanders is going to be, but I know that he's going to recruit, and I know that as long as they're able to hide their recruiting violations, I'm not going to say avoid them because we all know they're happening. As soon as they're able to hide their recruiting violations, that's a good program. They're going to do some big things. They're going to have talent. I'm excited to watch Jackson State.
Yeah, I think, you know, the Sun Belt, it's every year there is, it's constant talk about the Sun Belt, and it's kind of ironic because Conference USA pulled a bunch of old Sun Belt teams, and now they're like, huh, wait a minute, having a conference that goes from Miami, Florida to El Paso, Texas, up to Norfolk, Virginia, is maybe not the best conference financially when we're not making very much money. And so even I think there, I could see something where at least maybe for other sports, they do some type of scheduling agreement or just even blow it up and need a reshuffle and make those leagues more regional, because there's Texas schools in the Sun Belt and there's Florida schools in Conference USA, and just kind of get things back in the original footprint. But I don't know, now, at least in football, I don't think the Sun Belt really wants to do that, because a lot of those Sun Belt schools are in smaller towns that have a lot more institutional and community support. And, you know, you do have the App States and the Louisianas and now the Coastal Carolinas and those schools that are kind of, you're in a place where people kind of rally around it. Whereas some of the other Conference USA schools, like your Florida Atlantic or Florida International, you're fighting, you know, for attention, or in your UTSA or your UTEP, like it's the just small town community support isn't there. And so it kind of makes it harder to build a long-term program. So that is something to be interesting, keep an eye on, or maybe they just blow up their thing. Like, I think I saw the American is getting, they're not doing baseball schedules anymore.
That's too bad.
Well, so they are playing baseball, but they're having a conference tournament, and you are free to schedule however you want to, but it's regular seasons will be independently scheduled to save on travel costs. And they're not going to force Tulsa's baseball team to go down to Tampa Bay to play USF unnecessarily.
Well, there you go.
They're going to say, like, if you want to play each other, cool. If not, but we're not going to do, we're just going to do a regular season or a tournament to do the NCAA seeding.
We've talked about Mike Oresko. Like, the guy is a forward thinking dude. So good for them.
And I think, I mean, personally, I think there should be football conferences and everyone should be independent, and then everything else, like, separate everything else and hyper regionalize and save on costs, because they don't make you money anyway. So that rounds out our G5. Now let's hammer through the P5 really quick. Much less interesting storylines. USC is a 3-point favorite against Oregon after Washington got the vid and had to drop out. I don't think Oregon is that good this year, and I don't know how good USC is this year either. So I'm fine. This one's tough for me.
This is really tough. I was really hoping you were going to say a pick there so that I could just pick the opposite, because I could go either way. If I had to choose, I probably take USC. I don't know. Now I'm talking myself into Oregon. I think that Oregon is going to be a little bit more motivated to beat USC than USC is to finish undefeated and whatnot. So give me Oregon.
Okay. Where is USC? You know, you took Oregon. I'm going to go the opposite and say USC, because everybody wants to see USC fans more angry about going to another New Year's Six game because they can't fire their coach as a result.
Right. Okay.
Ohio State is a 21-point favorite against Northwestern.
That's a lot of points.
I'm taking Ohio State until they prove me wrong. Like, I don't think. I mean, no. I know Northwestern has a solid defense, but I think this game could be 21-0.
I'm not a believer in Northwestern. I want to make that clear. But 21 points is a lot against that defense. So just give me, I think Ohio State wins, but give me Northwestern and 21 points.
Okay. Oklahoma is a 5.5 point favorite at Iowa State.
It damn well better be Oklahoma, just because I'm so freaking tired of Iowa State. Like, they lost to Louisiana. That's it. That should be enough. So I don't know if Oklahoma covers, but I need them to cover in my heart.
Yeah, and I think Iowa State is good. I mean, they kind of have relied more on Brock Purdy and Breece Hall, I think is his last name, the running back. But I think Spencer Rattler is going to have – he's going to have a big day.
And it's a different – like, Oklahoma's playing good football right now. Right.
They've kind of – they struggled at the beginning of the year, but they've turned a corner. Okay, Clemson is a 10.5 point favorite on the road in South Bend for what is the first conference championship game of Notre Dame football history. And I got to say, I am taking the Fighting Irish here, because yes, Trevor Lawrence was out the first time they played, but DJ Uiagalelei, his play was not the reason they lost that game. He played great. He threw for over 400 yards, right? Like, it was not Clemson quarterback play, which is the only difference in this game between this one and the last one, is not why they lost. And 10.5 points is a lot, and Notre Dame is a good football team.
I thought I was going to be a little bit outside by picking Notre Dame, but you're right there with me. I think Notre Dame is going to be pissed. Like, I get it. They're playing the real Clemson now, and it's different. But I think Notre Dame's going to be pissed. They're an underdog in their home stadium and after they already beat this team once. So I don't know if they win, but give me 10.5 points in a pissed off Notre Dame. Absolutely give me Notre Dame.
What's interesting, this line opened at 7.5 and has moved to full field goal in Clemson's favor.
I don't get it. Give me the Irish. No, Ian Book is legit, guys. Like, he's unbelievable. He's been one of the best quarterbacks, probably the best quarterback that we're not talking about enough. So give me Notre Dame, and I really want them to win just so that they can, you know, hang a banner in South Bend of ACC champs for the 1 year they were in the ACC, and they can just look at it and be like, guys, this is why we're not at a conference. We went once, we won it. It wasn't great. Here we are now.
So I think we're both on board there with Notre Dame. SEC championship game, Bama is a 17.5 point favorite at the, for some reason, only dropped one GD spot, Florida Gators. I guess not at the Gators. I think the Gators are the home team, but it's played at the, in Atlanta at the Superdome.
Yeah. Yep. Mercedes-Benz Field, whatever that's called, their new one. Yeah. Give me Bama. They're going to win. Like, by 18, because they have to.
By 18.
Yeah. They absolutely have to restore order in the college football world. They have to do everything they can to make sure that Florida drops the rightful amount of spots that they should drop for Shoegate. So, yeah, give me Alabama.
I do not understand how, like, I don't know. We could do a whole other show about the committee in that, how little sense it made that Florida only dropped one spot. But looking at this is another line. It opened up at 14.5, now has moved to 17.5. And the average computer model is actually picking Bama to win by 18. So let's roll tide there. Go kiss your sister after they win. And our last game, we found the line, pulled it up. BYU is a 4-point favorite at a neutral site at the Boca Raton Bowl against the Central Florida Knights.
This game is going to be good. And the most exciting storyline to me is the Gabriel curse. That's what I'm calling it. That's what I wrote this week on Cougar Sports Insider about the Gabriel curse. Throughout the 80s, BYU would frequently, as everybody knows, would frequently go to Hawaii, right? And they would frequently play the Bows, and it was close games between the Cougars and the Rainbow Warriors, but BYU usually came out on top. And there was, on the islands, what became known as the BYU Jinx, because they just could not beat BYU. Until 1989, when Garrett Gabriel threw for 440 yards and absolutely annihilated the 18th ranked Cougars. Then the next year, Ty Detmer wins the Heisman, BYU is ranked fourth in the country, and he throws for 360 yards, a pair of touchdowns, runs for another yard. Garrett Gabriel, this is, as a senior now, runs for or throws for 360 yards, throws for two touchdowns, runs for another touchdown, and they just absolutely wax BYU the day after he after Detmer wins the Heisman. 2 years in a row, Garrett Gabriel beat BYU in just routes, absolutely routed BYU. Here we are now, 30 years later, and BYU is again ranked. They again have a Heisman-type quarterback who's on his way to the NFL, and they are again playing a Gabriel. Garrett Gabriel's son is Dylan Gabriel, who's an outstanding quarterback at UCF, and he is looking to beat BYU and continue the Gabriel curse. It was after that game in 1990, BYU didn't lose again to Hawaii for several years till 2001. Like, Garrett Gabriel was the only guy who could beat BYU for Hawaii. I think that it runs in his blood, and I think that BYU has the the antidote to reverse the curse of the Gabriels, and that is Mike Wilson's son. Mike Wilson, also from Hawaii, a Ute. We now have that blood at quarterback for BYU. So really, this is like a Hawaiian Ute blood that created Zach Wilson over this Gabriel blood that has this hex over BYU. And that's what's happening. This isn't even about BYU and UCF to me anymore. This is about which curse that lives in BYU lore is bigger. Is it the Ute blood? Is that the kryptonite for the Gabriels? Because Zach Wilson just wears the BYU jersey, but he was created with Ute blood. Is that enough to overcome Gabriel, this Gabriel curse that is such a has been such a thorn in the side for BYU every time they played a Gabriel? I like BYU. I don't like BYU by four. I think this is a field goal game. Comes down to Jake Oldroyd. So I'm taking UCF to cover, but I do think that in the battle of the bloods, I think that BYU's Ute-blooded quarterback, who's now a BYU legend, is what the Cougars needed to overcome the man who slayed BYU's Heisman Trophy winner all those years ago. That was a really weird explanation of how I got there.
You know,
but I'm there.
Okay, so you're taking UCF to cover. We want to all of that. Okay.
Yeah.
You know what? I'm going to take the Cougars. I think Zach Wilson, this is going to be his last hurrah. He'll be fired up. UCF's defense is very meh, and I think Zach Wilson is going to do very well. Obviously, UCF has an extremely high-powered offense. This is going to be a huge test for the BYU defense, but it also they are very dependent on – you know, they score in chunks and get big plays, and that's something that our defense is designed to stop. And, you know, we saw it last year with the USC game, and, you know, that's what try to keep things contained. And that's going to probably, to the annoyance of many, have a similar game plan that's rolled out. But if it works, it works. And we will see what happens. I think BYU will win. I think it's going to be a funky score. And we're going to see BYU by maybe, I don't know, I think five. We'll see. BYU will cover. It's going to be a weird score. BYU will win by five. And with that, give them hell. Jeff has just texted me to inform me that his children unplugged his router, so he is not able to say give them hell to us at the end of the show. But I will say it for him. Give him hell.